Welcome, all readers and listeners of Catholic Insight, to this continuing series of podcasts in our isolation. I'm speaking to you from my own home here in Good Friday, about 10:47 a.m. So a blessed Good Friday to one and all, or Triduum, or whenever you're listening to this. Maybe it's Easter joy already. So in the isolation, I am trying to reach out to our readers, give some distinction, some hope, some joy, some food for thought as we get along with our days as best we can. So today's topic is on rights and duties, particularly of Catholics, and how this applies to certain situations, but particularly to what we're facing now in the liturgical question. What someone asked me about hierarchically ordering the devotions that we might want to, in which we might want to participate, whether this be online masses, liturgies, home liturgies, or whatever else. So I'd rather, in many ways, when I teach my students, to give them principles, to teach them how to figure things out in their own way, I mean, insofar as I'm able to do that, and then they can use those principles in their own conscience to draw conclusions. There's very few things we can conclude a priori with any degree of certainty, and very few things are absolute in the moral life. Some are, but many things are left to our own, what St. Thomas More called the tangle of our own wits. So I ask my students sort of a thought experiment in class and say, is every right a duty and every duty a right? And some answer, of course, yes indeed. But if we take a second to ponder it, we'd realize not so fast that we have many rights that aren't duties. And you might think that every duty is a right. And oftentimes they are, but sometimes even our duties can be transcended by other duties and rights by other rights. The basic principle here is that rights and duties always exist in a context, that is, in a relationship. So we have rights before one authority we may not have before another authority. So rights are not things like elbows and noses that we have attached to us, even metaphysically, to our souls. Rights and duties always exist in a relationship. That is, and our relationships will always modify and change through life. Not all of them. Some of them are constant, and some are more constant than others. And let's just apply a few examples. For example, our rights and duties towards God are, generally speaking, constant and absolute. But even here, we have to put them into context and into a relationship that we have with others, with the state, with society, and with all the circumstances in which we find ourselves. So in a very, very general way, we could say that rights are those things, actions, or generally speaking, actions or even objective things that we may do, and duties are things that we're bound to do, or things that we have, what we must fulfill. So some things we have a right to, and we also have a duty to do them. But many of our rights, we don't have a duty unless we impose the duty upon ourselves. Take, for example, the notion of drinking from the last podcast. And by drinking, I mean drinking alcohol, having a beer or a glass of wine or a nip of scotch. And we would say, well, one has a right, generally speaking, to imbibe in alcohol, but there's rarely ever a duty to imbibe in alcohol. The only context I could think of, perhaps, is the priest at Mass has to take a small amount of wine to complete the sacrifice, at least the species of wine, which is obviously consecrated into the body and blood of Christ, to get all theological. But other rights and duties, let's take the example of marriage. A man has a right to marry, but that right can only be exercised in a particular context, in a very concrete way. He has to marry a woman, and the woman has to agree. And even if the woman agrees, she herself must not be married to someone else. Now, it becomes more complex. Let's say the woman is engaged to someone else. Well, engagement isn't a marriage vow, but it does impose some obligation and duty to marry the one to whom she said yes first. But in theory, she could break off the engagement and marry the man whom she feels more attracted or would make a more fitting spouse, or for whatever other grave and proportionate reason. Now, if the woman has a boyfriend, then the situation becomes more fluid, and she could agree to marry the suitor in a way if she thinks he is a better spouse. We also have the duty and the right to protect life. So there is what we call a right to life. But the right to life is not absolute. There is the principle of self-defense that we may harm an aggressor to the extent that stops him from causing harm. I won't get into the whole complexities of the death penalty at this point. That may be another podcast. But for the current context, in terms of protecting life, in protecting people from harm from a virus, well, there is some obligation, we would posit, to keep the vulnerable and those who are more prey, prey, to this virus safe. In what way and how? Well, that's a very controverted point because human beings in society also have a right to freedom. They have a right to congregate. They have a right to worship. They have a right to religious freedom. They have a right to move about as they see fit to an extent. And these rights may be abrogated by the state, by the executive branch, legislative branch of government, insofar as necessary to protect the common good, to protect certain citizens. But we might say, well, to what point is this? And here's the other element in the whole question, and that is truth. So we can only exercise rights and duties in the context of truth, and truth is objective. St. Thomas, as I think I mentioned before, defines truth as an adequatio rei et intellectus, that is, an adequation or a conformity between the mind and reality. So, insofar as things are real and we are aware of their reality, that is truth. So, truth itself is a relationship. And clearly, the question before us, in terms of the COVID virus, the COVID disease, COVID-19, is how real is its harm? When I don't mean it's not harmful, what I mean is to what extent is it harmful, to what extent of the population, and given those objective criteria, what is our response? And as I mentioned in the last podcast, there has to be a balance. There can't be an indefinite quarantining, and remember last time. What is meant by quarantining now is a universal and global lockdown of the entire population of the world, unprecedented in human history. And clearly, the harm that will eventually follow upon that would likely be far worse than any harm that could follow upon a virus and a contagion of a flu, which in most, if not almost all people, produces symptoms that will not lead to death. Time will tell, and there will be a reckoning and sort of an examination of all that we have done and not done, both in the church and in society, in terms of protecting ourselves from this virus and the rights and duties that flow therefrom. Keep in mind, there is not an absolute duty to protect life in all circumstances and situations. Clearly, death, as I said before, is an inevitability. And as I clarified in one of my writings recently, that we don't really save life. What we do is delay death. Only Christ can really save life per se. And death is a process ongoing through life, really. Memento mori, this life is nothing else but a preparation for death. There's a story told of a mother. When she sent her son to Eton, a public school in England, back when it was still quite religious, And she asked the headmaster, "Well, what will my boy learn in his years in Eton?" And the headmaster said, "To die, madam. He will learn how to die." And that really is the Christian response, that life is learning how to die well. And it's not about this life altogether. So a preparation for death. Now, we don't want to get all morbid about this, and obviously life should be rejoiced in, especially Easter time. Remember, Easter is about the resurrection, and it's not about Lazarus's resurrection, a resurrection to this life once again, only to die another day, but rather a resurrection to a life that will never end. And that is the point of life. And more to the point, that is the point of liturgy and worship. Liturgy and worship are not, and the church herself, it's not about saving lives. The church's mission is not, quote unquote, to save life, or even to delay death, or to fix our bodily lives, but to orient us, if you will, to put us into the right disposition so that we may enter heaven. St. Thomas says in the beginning of the Prima Secundae, those first five articles on man's last end, about what is the last end or the purpose of man? Now, man has many subsidiary purposes, that is, he has many ends or things he does in life to fulfill. He gets married, he raises children, he has a job, we study, we learn instruments, we play music, we have friendships, we have dinners. There's many aspects to life that are good, but all those things in life, all those good things, are ultimately ordered to the one thing, or the one being, more properly, who is good, that is God alone. And as the Curé d'Ars, St. John Vianney, used to say, if it can't be offered to God, then why do it? So back to rights and duties. Our rights and duties must always be rooted in objective truth. Many other religions have religious rights and duties and moral principles that flow therefrom that aren't true. Now, they may think they're true, and so there is this subjective element wherein in their conscience, which is not fully formed, they may think that going to Mass is an abomination, and that the Pope is the Antichrist and the Whore of Babylon or whatever else. Now, not many of them may put it this way in the modern era, but the early Protestants would have much more vivid language than we might speak now. And if they truly, quote-unquote, truly think that to be the truth, then they must act upon it until their conscience becomes more enlightened, purified, and perfected in light of objective truth. Now, objective truth itself, as I like to say, is a spectrum. There are things that are more important truths than other truths, and things that are more obviously true than other truths. And so the Catechism in paragraph 1860 says that no one is deemed ignorant of the principles of the moral law. So the natural moral law is imprinted in our hearts. And almost all religions across the world at least have something in common in terms of the natural moral law, that now even that's becoming unhinged in certain religions, with certain aspects of Islam advocating jihad in a way that would obviously violate the moral law, the killing of women and children, innocents, and so forth, that it's difficult to see how this would be justified in conscience, even in a disordered conscience. So to bring this back to marriage, before we get back to liturgy, we would usually agree as a society and as human beings that once someone has made a marriage vow, that they are bound by that vow. And that's why the church has always called divorce a great evil, that to undo what a God has bound together is going to have very deleterious consequences for society. And so the objective reality of marriage must be protected and maintained. And this also goes to the family. What is a family? Well, a husband, wife, that is a man, woman, bound in matrimony, along with their children. Anything else is just analogically a family and approximates thereto. Now, when we apply this to liturgy and to how we're meant to worship, well, there's only one perfect, true way to worship, and that is in the Catholic Church. All other forms of worship are, to some extent, somewhat outside this fold. That is, not worshipping God precisely in the way he'd like. Or I shouldn't say like. What is God like? He requires and asks us to be worshipped, ask him to be worshipped. Now that's not for his sake. God has no need of our worship and no need of our sacrifices. The reason God asks us to worship and live in a certain way is for our benefit, so that we, back to St. Thomas Aquinas and the Prima Secundae, may be made apt or fitting for heaven. And that is the whole point. And we have to order our minds, our souls, even our very bodies, in a way that is in accord with God's plan for man. That is, that we don't become so disordered that we become the kind of beings who cannot enter heaven. As Pope Benedict XVI puts it in Spes Salvi, that we become so self-centered and self-absorbed that we cannot reach out and see God. We become blinded, and that is what sin does. Again, not to get too morbid, even in the spiritual sense, we want to maintain and celebrate life, both at the natural and supernatural level. So let's focus on the affirmative and positive. Those of us locked in isolation, striving to keep our hearts and souls full of charity, joy, and grace, even without the sacraments. So I mentioned in the previous podcast that we are now left to the realm of what we call in theology the sacramentals. And the sacramentals are not sacraments, but they are things that approximate the sacraments and that are analogous to the sacraments. As the Catechism puts it, the main purpose of the sacramentals is to lead us and prepare us for the sacraments. And so everything from the rosary to adoration to our own private prayers, stations of the cross, all and our morning prayer, evening prayer, examination of conscience, holy water, medals, scapulars, all those are sacramentals, even images, icons, paintings we see around us in our homes. They lead us towards the sacraments. Now, in the current isolation, they're leading us towards the sacraments in a way. In the future, I mean, obviously, this would hopefully be a daily, if not perhaps a weekly thing in most of our lives, leading us towards the Mass in particular. But we are now left to looking forward towards the Mass and the sacraments in some future date, hopefully not too long from now. The one sacrament I hope most of our listeners can participate in is confession. I know some dioceses have not allowed confessions. Fortunately, the diocese in which I live has, and our pastor is very open to confession, and we're very happy for that. So if you can't, well then, let's look at what a sacramental can do, and the order of sacramentals. Now, to order the sacramentals in terms of what may benefit us most, we go back to that distinction between objective and subjective. And objective means it's more objectively true, that is linked to the truth at that level of reality. And then subjective means what is within our own minds, particular minds, but also our hearts and our proclivities, our affections. And one would hope that the objective and the subjective link up, that what we feel or think to be subjectively true is also what is objectively true. Now, if they're unhinged, well, that is what we call falsity, right? So falsity is where what we think does not conform to reality. But even here, we must make distinctions, because sometimes a thing that may be objectively the best thing may not subjectively be the best thing for us in those circumstances. Remember the virtue of prudence. Prudence is the virtue of the practical intellect by which we discern the true good in every circumstance and the right means to attain it. Now, the true good in every circumstance may be different for different people. The Church has always taught that consecrated life is objectively more perfect than the married or single state. But that doesn't mean that the married or single state is not subjectively more perfecting for most individuals, or at least marriage for most individuals, let's put it that way, than the consecrated life, which is a gift given to few of us. St. Philip Neri used to say it's the greatest gift Our Lady could give to any soul, but God gives the gift, and we must respond. To to the gift as it is given, whether that gift be consecrated life, married life, single life, or whatever other path. Now, at a more daily level, we have the sacraments and the sacramentals. Objectively speaking, a sacramental is more perfect the more perfectly it orders us and disposes us for the sacraments. So the closer it approximates the sacraments. So we would say, for example, that adoration is more perfect than reading Thomas A Kempis at home. Adoration is a sacramental, but it is very connected with the sacrament. Obviously, the Blessed Sacrament is there before us, and we pray in the presence of God himself. Well, few things could be more perfect. But we can't do adoration all day long. There are other things in life, other aspects, and other aspects of our own being that must be perfected. We have to exercise. We have to also stock our intellect with truths, both supernatural truths, reading the Bible, reading the Catechism, spiritual books within the context of our devotional life, and also feed our, quote-unquote, our passions and our bodies insofar as we need sleep, we need rest, we need food, we need friendship, we need companionship, we need to interact with others, and all sorts of things that lead to our integral perfection. So someone wrote in and asked, well, what is the benefit, for example, on the value of live stream masses versus recorded masses versus doing the readings of the day versus, for example, sleeping in? Well, there is a hierarchy there in the objective level in terms of devotion life. And remember, Aristotle says that everything, whenever we do something, intention is first in the order of execution. So we ask ourselves first, well, why are we doing this? And do we need it? And then once we figure out why we're doing it and whether we need it and how we need it, and then we do it or don't do it as circumstances and all those means would lead us to that decision in the moral life. So sometimes we do have to sleep in some days, and some days are meant for sleeping in. Generally speaking, we should have a fixed hour of rising and what Vatican II calls a ratio vitae, a plan of life. And so obviously sometimes you have to sleep. Okay. So in terms of the other things, I would say that a live stream mass is better than a recorded mass, because at least in a live stream mass, you're participating with the mass in real time. And so the objective grace of the mass is there present before you, even if it's at a distance. So yesterday I put on the mass of monks in Baru in France, an old rite liturgy that was going on at 5 o'clock their time. It was the Mass of the Lord's Supper, and it was 11 a.m. my time. I put a little note about it in Catholic Insight. And even though they were thousands of miles away, we could still pray with them, with the monks at that time, and saying their Mass. And it's not ideal, of course. And I generally, at most of the Mass, I just put the audio on, part of it because the video was kept skipping or pausing. But the audio allowed me to visualize in my mind what the monks were doing while also praying through the Mass and the readings. Recorded Masses, I would say objectively, are of lesser value because obviously they're not taking place at the same time. And you're watching sort of just a movie of Mass. And so obviously, even in live stream Mass, you're kind of watching a movie of Mass, but at least the movie of the Mass, the film of the Mass, is taking place in real time. And so you can still visualize the Mass taking place in that real time and participate in it. Time and space are very significant in our devotion and liturgy, as Cardinal Ratzinger made clear in his Spirit of the Liturgy. I'd highly recommend that, his year 2000 book. It's very easy and accessible. And if you get a chance to glance through that, and particularly how the liturgy is linked with the cosmos, with the movement of the moon and the sun, and even Easter. The Council of Nicaea declaring that Easter, after much wrangling, was going to be held on the first Sunday after the first full moon, after the vernal equinox. That sounds kind of very earthy, but that's what liturgy is. Doing the day's readings is also very devotional, and that could be more devotional than watching a mass in some ways. Now, it depends what your proclivities are. I would say if you feel if you want to watch Mass or live stream Mass, well, there's ways of doing the readings with the Mass, doing the readings before the Mass, so you're able to meditate on the readings. Meditation, I would say, is one of the highest things we can do in the spiritual life, that what Catechism again calls the daily colloquy. And colloquy is that collocore, that is to speak together with God, meditation. And you could ally that with daily Mass. You could listen to audio of daily Mass. I mean, if you feel, you could even go to a church where there is daily Mass and pray outside. And that gets a bit complex with the current strictures in society put upon us in terms of gathering and whatnot. Well, these COVID days are upon us. There's also the Rosary, Stations of the Cross. Those are all very valuable actions, and they even have a plenary indulgence attached to them under certain conditions. And so in the spiritual life, we choose in our lives what we must do, and we choose based on that objective element, what value has it objectively, and then we ally that with the subjective benefit to us. How will it benefit us in both devotional life and also our psychological and spiritual life, bodily life, and even the life of our families, right? So those with whom we live, and how is it benefiting the children, our spouses, if you are married in that married life, or those people with whom we live, siblings or whatever else, friends, and those with whom we may be able to gather even in these small, limited ways with these strictures upon us. Anyway, I hope that helps for now. Back to those rights and duties, and you can apply them with prudence and with counsel. I may counsel, obviously, being the gift of the Holy Spirit that elevates and perfects prudence. And so it's not just a rational act of man himself or our own brains, but God helps us. That is, God elevates and perfects. And so listen to your heart. Listen to that voice deep within us, the still small voice that Elijah heard on that mountain. And God will speak to us and speak to you in your own way. And we will discern our way through this by the grace of God. And as we journey through these days, we will pray for each other. I may send out another little message close to Easter and the silence of Good Friday and Holy Saturday. In the meantime, I wish all of you many graces, many blessings, and let us, as always, pray for one another. Oremus pro invicem, semper in Domino.